Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, where we feature community conversations around South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel throughout our community and listen to local groups discuss what matters to them. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ammon Swenson. Today we have a very special episode of Addressing Alaskans. Coming up this hour, we'll hear stories from Teacher Tales. The event was presented in the format of The Moth and Arctic Entries and celebrates educators and all that they do. It was presented by Hearthkin and Sea Stories. The event took place earlier this year at the Beartooth Theater, and these stories were re-recorded for this program. Up first, we have Becky Toussaint.
What do you want to be when you grow up? By a quick show of hands, how many of you have been asked this question for as long as you can remember? Exactly. I don't know at what point we decided that five-year-olds should have their entire career path mapped out, but we did. And so now, whenever we ask them, we shouldn't be surprised when we hear them say the coolest thing they've learned about thus far, an astronaut. I mean, who doesn't want to float around in space, defying gravity and eating dehydrated ice cream? Then, as they get a little bit older, we hear things like professional basketball player, rock star, or maybe even brain surgeon. And by the time we ask them when they're in high school, we hear something that didn't even exist when I was in high school, a TikTok star. But for me, I always knew exactly what I wanted to be from a very young age. I wanted to be a vet. I had that little cardboard blue pet vet kit, and all of the stuffed animals in my house always had bandages and routinely got their heartbeats checked by my plastic stethoscope. Then, in fourth grade, we had a whale of a bake sale, where we raised money by selling cookies to adopt a whale. Now, please keep in mind that I grew up in the mountains of Colorado, which is about as landlocked as it can get. But nevertheless, we raised our money and we adopted an orca. And from that moment forward, I became obsessed with marine mammals, especially whales and dolphins. So the next time somebody asked me, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" the answer was clear. I wanted to be a... You might be thinking marine biologist? Nope, a dolphin vet. And from there, I did everything I was supposed to. I took all the hard science classes, I got good grades, and I graduated high school and applied to Colorado State, which was the second best vet school in the nation. Go Rams. And as I sat in school on the first day, my professor asked me, "What kind of vet do you want to be?" And I proudly proclaimed, "A dolphin vet." To which he said, "A what?" So a little bit louder and just as proud, I said, "A dolphin vet." Turns out his "a what" was not because he hadn't heard me, but because there really is no such thing as a dolphin vet. So at this point, all of my hopes and dreams came crashing to a halt, and I had to reassess what it is I wanted to be when I grow up. So I went back to the two people who I thought might be able to help me the best, which were my high school science teachers. And after a lot of discussion about who I was as a person and what I was passionate about, we decided that I really love coaching snowboarding because I love taking something I was passionate about and helping others learn to love it. So maybe I would be a good science teacher since I was passionate about science. Go figure. My high school science teachers encouraged me to be a science teacher, but you know, whatever. I went back to school that spring semester and enrolled in a dual degree in natural science and education, and I've never looked back. However, after about a year of teaching high school science and having students ask me, "Why do we need to know this?" I realized I really couldn't tell them. I'd gone right from high school to college and then back to high school, and I'd never been a scientist. So after that year, I quit my job, and I decided to move to Alaska, where there were big mountains to snowboard on, and I figured a lot of science I could do. And after I got to Alaska, I got a job as an environmental scientist, and I spent 4 years traveling around the state and working on really amazing projects. But I realized it just wasn't where my heart was. So I decided it was time to go back to education, and I felt like I could really start to answer that question, why, if I was back in the classroom. Right about that time, I found a small nonprofit that spent their days traveling around the state teaching students and teachers about our natural resources. And 12 years later, I still work for that same nonprofit. And with this organization, I've been able to have amazing experiences, both inside and out of the classroom. On one of my first trips, I got to go to the North Slope to Ukiavik, where right when I landed, the people who were picking me up said, Do you want to go see a whale? Yeah, let's go. So as we drive out to the beach where the whole community was, and that whaling captain brought that whale ashore, I first realized, probably not much I'm going to be able to do with my pet vet kit. So instead, I sat back and enjoyed the six-hour cultural experience as that captain and his crew shared their harvest with their community. And I just never could have imagined that the most amazing experience I would ever have with a whale would be eating it. The muktuk was chewy and hard, but the whale meat itself was actually really good. 10-year-old me would be so disappointed right now. But beyond experiences like that, I've had really great opportunities in the classroom, getting to teach students about our natural resources and helping them find their passions and align those passions with real jobs right here in the state of Alaska. And now I get to be the science teacher that they come back to when they're trying to figure out what they want to be when they grow up. And unlike my science teachers, I help them find jobs where they actually make twice what I make in nonprofit education. Not that we're here for the money or anything. Although I do wonder what a dolphin vet would make. Anyhow, I absolutely love what I do, and I wouldn't change it for the world. Not even SeaWorld. And it's working out pretty well for me, because it turns out I'm pretty scared of sharks.
That was Becky Toussaint. Up next is Caitlin Lanier-Moylan.
In the summer of 2020, I walked into the Whaley School to interview for a position as a TA, and I walked out as a long-term substitute teacher in charge of my very own classroom for the first time ever. I would later become aware that that parking lot was closely monitored by video cameras, which means there is permanent video evidence of me doing a happy dance. But I feel like it was warranted, because for the first time, all of my teaching goals was finally everything was coming together. There was one tiny problem. No, it wasn't 2020 COVID related. It was that I am a history major, and this was a math teaching position. But I figured, it's okay, 2 months before the school year starts, I'll just learn all of math, because that's how that works, right? So I buckled down. I spent those 2 months studying. I taught myself everything from place value to dividing exponents, and I really wanted to focus on different methods of teaching, because in high school, what I really struggled with was that my brain worked in a way that, in a different way than how the textbook worked. And that caused me a lot of anxiety and frustration that I didn't want my future students to have to go through. It turned out, though, that despite all my cramming, I actually used very little of that information. Let me explain. The Whaley School is not your typical school. It is this lovely one-story brown building on the east side of Anchorage, home to about 300 students who are in need of extra social, emotional, and behavioral support. So what that looked like in my day-to-day is we weren't focusing so much on place value as we were the value of boundaries. Not a lot of multiplication, a lot of communication. And I definitely learned with these students, I needed to tell them that I loved them because I didn't know when they were going to hear it next. And I'm very glad we never got to exponents, because I'm still not confident that I know how those work. When I tell other educators that I got my start at Whaley, they generally say something to the effect of, wow, you must have a thick skin, or dang, dodged a couple of tables in your day, huh? And they're not entirely wrong. I've certainly been called a few creative names. And yes, there was one time that after suggesting that it might not be the best time to play a computer game, I had to duck a Chromebook. But there are more interesting stories of times that Chromebooks were thrown, and that's what I want to focus on. There's this one student, we're going to call him Lucas, who could not have cared less about math. He would walk in, talk under his breath about me, his classmates, the class itself. With a lot of prompting and support, he could maybe get a couple of problems done, but usually it would result in his head on the table and his papers and all the supplies flung off on the floor. But he was paying attention, because I saw the light go off one day when we were talking about fractions, of all things. Fractions did it. But you know what? The light went off and it stayed there. He understood and he was proud of himself, and it was a beautiful thing to see. Suddenly, instead of talking under his breath about other kids, he was helping them. He started moving his table next to my desk so that he could ask me questions, so that we could talk about the process of solving things. Eventually, we started talking about his life outside of school. He told me about why he hits his head against the wall and why his fingernails are bloody a lot of the time. We really started to trust each other. And then the dreaded standardized testing came around, and he got to the math section. I saw something happening, his body tensing up, and I could tell there was some anxiety coming out. Those coping mechanisms that we'd all been working on were not being used. And it was because he didn't understand how that section of the math worked. So out of frustration, he threw his computer on the ground. And he told me he was so scared that meant he wasn't going to be able to move on to the next math class. That's right. This kid loved math so much that he chucked his computer on the ground. And honestly, I am going to consider that a teaching win. All of this made me realize that life problems, a lot like math problems, we're all just trying to find the solution. But our brains just take wildly different routes getting there. Everybody, no matter what, needs to learn those basic skills that are taught at Whaley. Setting boundaries, learning effective communication, and how to show love. I made it 1 year at Whaley. At the time, I just did not have the tools to be there for myself in a healthy way. And teachers also need to set boundaries. As soon as a history position became open in a neighborhood school, I happily accepted it. And that brings me a lot of shame. Because I think about, what if I was just another adult who said, I love you, you can trust me, and then I left. And I wish that I could tell you that Lucas went on to be a math major or have some great job in computer science. That would be a really nice end to this story. But the fact is that I don't know, and we lost touch, and I am ashamed of that. But I do take those lessons that I learned and take them into my classroom today. Those lessons about boundary setting and effective communication. And so in my history class, if my kids walk out knowing nothing about the American Revolution, but they can set a boundary, then I have done my job as a teacher. And I will always, always tell my students that I love them. Thank you.
That was Caitlin Lanier-Moylan. Our next storyteller is Ellie Vandevis.
I didn't know that plants and soil have souls and that they can actually tell me exactly what they need until I read The Findhorn Garden. Long before you'd ever heard of plant communication, these three authors were consciously connecting and communicating with angelic intelligences in their garden in beach sand in Northern Ireland. They were not psychics, nor were they shamans, nor were they praying at them. They were opening their hearts and receiving specific guidance about how to deal with weeds, soil, pests from these energy or essences or nature intelligences, angels, spirits of nature, devas, or whatever you want to call them. Their vegetables were gigantic. For a Michigan transplant who had no job and was in spiritual crisis, this book and then the Perelander Garden books were inspiring me. I want this. So I rip up the sod in the front yard and plant my first market garden near Palmer. I dive in with complete faith and absolutely no Alaska agricultural experience. Which fertilizers? What to compost? What does this soil need, lime? Now it's mid-June and I'm checking on my emerging crops. Uh-oh. My 60 feet of broccoli are shrinking, not growing. And they're a sickly purple. Cabbage root maggots have attacked. I'm scared. Will I lose my whole crop? I try copying what Michelle Small Wright did in her Perelander garden. I walk the rows with an authoritative voice. I understand you are a part of nature, but I need this crop for my income. Please only take the first and last plants from each row. Thank you. Next day, more shrinking broccoli. More sickly purple. In despair, I corner some friends into talking to the energy of cabbage root maggots. Let's quiet our minds, ask what's going on, and see what we sense in our inner selves. We piece together our impressions. One hears, "Call me Charlie." I immediately think of my 8-year-old friend Charlie, whose smile brightens up the entire burrow. Others intuit happy, busy beings who convey, "You think we are ugly and a threat to a successful garden. We think you are just not seeing us in a true light. The truth is, we are jovial beings. We are beautiful. We are always in the soil. You'll never eradicate us. Besides, you need us. You need us to teach you how to talk to the other devas. You are just a beginner. It's good, good, good that you contact us. We'd like to help you." "Okay, Charlie the cabbage root maggot. How to deal with so many of you in the broccoli without poisons?" Charlie expounds. "Plant a perimeter of radish seeds around your broccoli. When the radishes grow a little, pull them and compost them and repeat twice more." I try this and it works. Charlie has taught me about using a trap crop or a sacrifice crop. Charlie is also teaching me to stop the command, stop the control, stop the arrogance. Become humble and converse. Initiate two-way communication with deep respect. This leads to cooperating, negotiating, and finally co-creating the best solution for everyone. I continue to ask for garden guidance, like what to do about wasps. It's mid-August and the vegetables are maturing, but we're getting stung. We discover a paper wasp nest at the edge of the garden. We ask them to move out. They say, "You want us to move away? We are your pollinators extraordinaire. Our nest is well established. We cannot move and rebuild when the first frosts are only 2 weeks away. Instead, we say, wait until dark. Surround yourself with a calm mind. You can move us at night." Keep a calm mind. It's midnight, and I am a nervous pool of sweat under my rain suit and head net. Why am I even believing wasps? The second I start cutting the hive off the branch, the zzzz explodes. The bundle I carry in my hands is a rolling, throbbing, riling military enclave. I walk it over and set it down in the new location, step back, and oh my gosh, all the wasps are still in their hive. They did tell me the truth. Paper wasps will not fly in the dark. One balmy night, I crave to sleep on the beach. Never mind that I have no tent. I throw down some makeshift bedding. Ah, I revel in the sound of gentle waves and drift up. Ow! Ow! Ooh! Ow! Quick! I jump with multiple bites. It's sand fleas. Oh, dear sand fleas, I have plopped myself right into your territory. Would you consider a merciful move totally out of my circle just for tonight so I can sleep on the beach and on Mother Earth? In a few minutes, the stinging bites recede and I fall asleep. Those sand fleas are perfect gentlemen. I keep asking Mother Nature, talking with slugs and skunks, ants and aphids, worms and wildfire. This has taught me more about love than preachers, books, and churches. So I ask, do you recommend I teach about the joys of interspecies cooperation and co-creation in the garden classes I teach? The answer was curt. Don't make it another church. Well, okay. I've done two things. I've compiled my encounters in a book called Ask Mother Nature, A Conscious Gardener's Guide. And yes, I do teach to those who don't think I have sold my soul to the devil. And then participants call me up. Ellen, Jack tells me he asked the birch aphids to lower their populations in his yard instead of calling an exterminator, and they did. And Kim reports that she asked the whiteflies thick on her houseplant to lower their populations. They disappeared overnight, and she had to call me. Have all problems vanished by asking nicely? No, that's the rare case. But that just means it's time to ask more, empathize more, and listen more deeply. I have much to learn about being a respectful member of the circle of life.
That was Ellie Vandevis. Up next is Willie Kennedy.
Come on, everybody, clap your hands. Come on, everybody, clap your hands. Come on, everybody, because we're going to have a party. Come on, everybody, clap your hands. Come on, everybody, stomp your feet. Come on, everybody, stomp your feet. Come on, everybody, because we're going to have a party. Come on, everybody, stomp your feet. Come on, everybody, say teach your tails. Teach your tails. Come on, everybody, say teach your tails. Teach your tails. Come on, everybody, because we're going to have a party. Come on, everybody, say teach your tails. Teach your tails. Yeah, guys, how's that feel? Feels good, right? Feels good to sing. Feels good to dance. Feels good to let loose and be silly. Keeps you amped. Keeps you energized. Keeps you feeling young. But guess what, guys? I realize I'm not that young anymore. I'm getting kind of old. Or older, I should say. I received an invitation in the mail the other day from a former student of mine. A graduation invitation. A college graduation invitation. A medical college graduation invitation. And it hit me. I've been doing this for a very long time. I have been in early childhood education for 23 years. Yeah, I know, 23 years. And no matter how many responsibilities I've had, no matter how many different roles I've played in this field, I have always told people, first and foremost, I am a preschool teacher. More importantly, a Montessori preschool teacher. I believe in the Montessori method wholeheartedly. For you guys that don't know, Montessori is all about three simple main principles: care of self, care of others, care of the environment. Simple as that. I attended Polaris K-12 here in Anchorage, and I'm not going to say I wasn't a fan of school. I really wasn't a fan of school. I'm not going to say I skipped class a lot. I just wasn't in class when I was supposed to be in class, if you know what I mean. And my advisor was like, you know, what do you want to do? What's going on? I was like, you know, school's not necessarily for me, but I do enjoy, you know, working around, you know, younger children. And so she's like, you know, you can volunteer in the elementary classes and get credit for it. And I was like, wait, if I have to be at school doing the things that I don't want to do, like, you know, math and history and all that, I can get credit for volunteering in the elementary classes? She's like, yeah. So I did that, and that really opened up my eyes and like, you know what, this is awesome, you know, being around children, kind of being, you know, a mentor and an educator. So I did that for a while, and one of my other teachers said, hey, Willie, have you heard of a place called Puffin Heights Montessori? And I was like, no, never have. And she's like, you know, you should check them out. If you like working with kids, it might be something you could really be good at. So let me paint you guys this picture. Here's me in high school, big old afro, big baggy shirt, baggy pants, probably wearing a chain. And I show up to Puffin Heights and I'm like, yeah, I want to do this. And the owner at the time, Leslie, she's like, let's do it. So that was my first experience working in early childhood education. And I worked there for probably about 7-8 months before returning back to school to finish up my senior year. Now, you know, dreaded school. I had to get back there and do all the classes that I didn't want to do. But I learned about a program at the King Career Center in their early childhood education department. And I was like, you know what? This is right up my alley. So I enrolled in that class, and I remember showing up on the first day, and there were 15 other students in the class ready to be educators. 14 of them were girls, and then myself. Now, mind you, I wanted to be there, but now I really wanted to be there, if you know what I mean. Jokes aside. But, so I'm there, and I remember the two teachers in the classroom were not only educators to the young children in the classroom, the preschoolers, but also to the student teachers that were there. And I was like, wow, this is a big responsibility. You're wearing a lot of hats. You know, there's big roles that, you know, that you're doing. And I really just kind of, you know, had an appreciation for what they were doing. So I did KCC, and once I was done with that, I was, you know, in high school, and I was at a crossroads, you know, upon graduation. I was like, do I take my, you know, undersized, mediocre at best talent, love for basketball, and try to pursue a career in that, like every other, you know, kid in America, you know, in my position? Or do I go into early childhood education? And I didn't know it then, but I know it today. And I think all teachers can, you know, agree on this, that teaching is never, ever about the income. It's always about the outcome. And today I know that wholeheartedly. But back then I didn't. It took me some time to figure it out. So naturally I called Puffin Heights and I was like, hey, can I come back? And Leslie was like, sure, let's do it. So I went back to Puffin Heights and I worked there for a while before I was like, you know what? What do I want to do? What does my career path look like? So I enrolled in a program down in Boulder, Colorado, called the Montessori Education Center of the Rockies. And I remember getting there and I walked in and, you know, mind you, I'm ready to be an educator. I'm ready to be a Montessori educator. And there's 35 other people in the class, 34 women and myself. And I was like, oh, here we go again. So I knew what was going to happen. I knew the position I was in, but that's when it really hit me. I was like, man, there are not a lot of guys in early childhood education. So I knew what I was doing was important. It was special. And it was something that, you know, I had to stick with. So I finished up my Montessori education and I came back to Puffin Heights doing my practicum. And I've worked with a lot of great teachers. I've worked with a lot of great mentors. But, you know, none more special than Leslie Barrera. She allowed me to really, you know, become the teacher that I am today and the person that I am today. She gave me freedom of kind of, you know, what I wanted to do in the classroom, how I wanted to, you know, kind of integrate all the things that I've learned, all the things that, you know, that were special to me. She allowed me to really be the teacher that I am. In 2016, I had the privilege of purchasing Puffin Heights from Leslie, which, you know, I accepted right away. And I have been the owner now for the last 8 years of Puffin Heights Montessori. So I owe a great deal of gratitude, appreciation, and just love for the field that I'm in. And, you know, everything, you know, it goes back to Leslie and her kind of just her vision for me and our visions together. So I love it that 23 years in the making, you know, it all comes full circle. I'm here today kind of sharing that story. We should sing a song. You guys ready? We are all animals. We make sounds every day. And people come for miles around to hear us make sounds this way. Us snakes. They love to hear us snakes. We are all animals, we make sounds every day, and people come for miles around to hear us make sounds this way. Us dogs, they love to hear us dogs. Last one, guys. We are all animals, we make sounds every day, and people come for miles around to hear us make sounds this way. Us frogs, they love to hear us frogs. Thanks, everybody.
That was Willie Kennedy. You're listening to Addressing Alaskans on Alaska Public Media. Today's program features stories from Teacher Tales, a storytelling event celebrating educators and all that they do.
Don't know much about history, don't know much biology, don't know much about a science book, don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I love you. If you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
The next storyteller is Ricky Lind.
My name is Galichuk. My English name is Ricky Lind Jr. and I've been teaching music since 2008. The story I'm sharing is from those days when I was in Dillingham, which is in southwest Alaska. You can only get there by boat or plane, which makes it truly rural. And the landscape is mostly tundra, but we have everything there from the freshwater system, the river system, lake system, and the salt ocean, of course, which makes it abundant for subsistence, which is not politically correct anymore. We have to call it traditional hunting and gathering. So it takes place about my fourth or fifth year of teaching where I was expected to host the Region 1 Music Festival. And that's not something that when you major in music at the university, that they prepare you for. And so I've had to do a lot of networking because it's not what you know, it's usually who you know. And that's why I was successful in with this event and hosting it, because at the Region 1 Music Festival, we invite Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, and even Tuntutuliak was in attendance at this time. And it's high school students grades 9 through 12, whether they're in a band or a choir or even have a solo to perform. And so that means I've had to do a lot of organizing for this event. I was teaching music at the time, elementary in the morning, middle high school band and choir in the afternoon. And preparing for the festival, we were given a budget from ASAA, and I had to do the rest myself. I had to organize the rooms where the students would be sleeping in, the menu from the kitchen, arrange an agenda, a program, several programs, because each one had a program. There's a program a day. For example, the first day when the students arrive, I had a Beyonce concert. Of course, not the real Beyonce. It was on Blu-ray. And so the students were excited to see that on a big screen. And the story takes place this night, the first night of the Region 1 Music Festival, where after the Beyonce concert, which I didn't actually see, I was taking the guest clinicians and conductors who were just in from the airport to the Airbnb next to our school. And when I arrived at the school, I just know that the elementary is separate from the middle high school, but they are just one parking lot away. It's a single site school district. So in order to get from one school to the next, you have to go across the parking lot, and only the bus route was paved. So you can imagine the potholes that were in the parking lot every year. And it's in the spring, so it's still kind of chilly out, but there's, you know, warm moments during the day, but it's still mostly chilly weather because the music festival is held in the springtime. And so this night I had gotten the guest conductors during the Beyonce concert, and the following day would be the guest conductor and clinicians concert where the students could hear professionals perform. And I think my students were more excited to be spending the night at the school than they were to hear the performers perform. But this night, the male students were with me in the elementary school, and the female students were with a chaperone in the middle high school. And I arranged that because I knew that female students sometimes like to curl their hair. And previously, I saw a coach curling her hair in the elementary hallway one weekend. And that helped me know that when I host something, I should have the male students at elementary school so that the female students could curl their hair at an outlet, you know, in the locker room, you know, where there's a mirror. So I was at the elementary school, and it was in the middle of the night, and it was probably about 3 a.m. and my students were still awake with me. They were playing whatever console was popular at the time. I'm not quite sure if it was a PlayStation or a Nintendo of some type. But it was 3 a.m, and I had skipped dinner the night before because of the Beyonce concert. And the students, you know, they're always hungry. So in the school, it's nighttime. It's 3 a.m. It's the elementary school. The school itself, you know, smells kind of dusty. It's a big, you know, public Title I school, so it smells kind of dusty, and it's very dark. This is rural Alaska, so the utilities are through the roof, so I can only imagine why. The janitor at night always turned the lights off, made sure that the lights were off. And so they were willing to follow me to the kitchen because I had skipped dinner, and it was spooky. The hallway was long and dark and quiet because not only the floor was carpet, also the walls were carpet. And it's the commercial carpet. If you fell, you'd get a rug burn. So they followed me to the kitchen, which still to this day has the same blue linoleum. It had the same blue linoleum when I was a student there growing up. And so I tried my master key, which I thought was a master key. At the double doors, at the side door, it wouldn't work. And so I went outside to the delivery door, which is a single door with a metal handle that you would find at any regular public building. And it was frozen shut. It would not move. The key fit, but it wouldn't turn. I can only imagine the students, you know, standing behind me in the dark blue linoleum cafeteria, and I'm there and hopeless, you know, without the door being able to open. It wouldn't even jingle because it was frozen shut. The wind is blowing from the north. It was chilly that night too. So I said how my grandma taught me to pray. She would say, you need to pray like this. And I did. I said, Lord, I come before your throne of grace, asking forgiveness of my sins, committed knowingly and unknowingly. Ask you in my heart again since we last spoke, and I boldly ask you to open this door. because I am so hungry. And it's the middle of the night, and my students are here with me. They're hungry, too. And the door didn't move. So I turned, and disappointed, started to, you know, get back into that door where the students were waiting for me. And we heard a click. I turned. The door had opened on its own after being frozen shut. And my key wouldn't work in there. So I didn't even thank Jesus. We both, you know, shouted with glee, and we went in there and we got the leftover pizza from the night before and the lime green jello and those little white styrofoam cups at the lid. We brought them back to our room, and I finished the program, you know, for the following day. And we went to sleep with full bellies. And so my faith would call this story a testimony too. And thank you for listening.
That was Ricky Lind. Our next storyteller is Allison Tebow. This story does include a suicide.
So I need you all to rub your hands together with me. And on the count of three, we're going to clap together. Okay? And it's a one, two, three, then clap. Power clap on three. One, two, three. Awesome. You just did a power clap. The power clap is something that I started as a teacher to make sure that our classes were ending together, really focusing on we begin our class together, we end together, and starting as this little tradition. So I wanted to tell you kind of the evolution and some stories about the influence and impact that the power clap ended up having in building community with students. So it's the first day of school in 2016, and it's freshman English first period. And this year, I'm doing something a little different. So when the bell rings, I walk in, I shut the door behind me, and I walk to my desk, and I sit down, and I stare back at the students in silence. I pretend to do some work on my computer. I take my phone out, and there are no phones allowed in my classroom. And I pretend to text. I even take a selfie. And the kids are just staring back at me. Sometimes they shush each other. They're not doing anything, but I am trying to wait them out. And finally, 27 minutes later, one young man raises his hand and he says, "Excuse me, is there something that we should be doing?" And I jump up and I say, "Yes, thank you so much for asking. Why did you let me waste your time?" And they just stare back at me really unsure. And we have this conversation about how important it really is for them to be their own advocates and to really pay attention that it's okay to like take time if you need it, but don't let people waste your time. Even if it's your teacher, our job is here to educate you. Don't let yourself waste your time. You're here to learn. And I asked them several questions and they had to respond afterward. And the questions were, what do you want to do differently this year than you have done in the past? What do you need from me to help you be successful in that? And what do you want for me to know about you that's important to you? Miss Tebow, I need for you to give me everything you've got this year because I'm here to really work hard and I need for you to give me everything you've got too. Miss Tebow, I need for you to know that English is not my best subject, but I really am always trying. Miss Tebow, I need for you to know that if I'm missing school, it's because I'm helping taking care of my siblings and my family. I'm not skipping. I just have to take care of them, so I might miss school. It's the fall in 2019 on a Monday with seniors in a humanities English elective. And I walk in knowing that this day is going to be very different because it's the first school day after a young man died from suicide in this graduating class. This group of seniors has lost four of their classmates since their freshman year to various things. So I know that when they come in, today is not going to be a day where we cover content. We're not doing the lesson. And this group of students who normally come into this classroom full voice, chest singing Whitney Houston are silent and they're hunched over and they're looking back at me. And I know that we're going to do something different again today. So I tell them that instead of sharing good things this morning, we're going to share what we're grateful for. And each of us is going to go around and share that because we can't always say what's good, but we can always say what we're grateful for. And each student's going around and around until I notice that the class of 34 has one empty chair. And that chair belongs to a young man who is best friends with the student who had just died. And we get around and we're almost to that empty chair and the door opens and in walks that young man. And he shuts the door behind him, and he goes and sits down. And the person who sits next to him says, "I'm really grateful that Robert is here today." And he's sitting there in his chair, and he's just nodding his head. And he looks up, and he says, "You know, this is the first class I've gone to all day today. And it was really important to me that I come to this class because you all are really important to me. So today I'm really grateful for you, all of you, and for this class." And we get up, we finish up and go around. And I tell them, "Okay, we're going to take these paper plates and these Sharpies, and you're going to pin the paper plate to your back. And we're going to go around, and I want all of you to write what you're grateful for about that person on this plate. So when we leave here today, you're going to have evidence of how very much you are cared for." And I said, "We're going to do this for 15 minutes. I'll turn on some music. We'll get up and go." The timer goes off, and there's these conga lines of gratitude where students are just back to back to back writing what they're grateful for about their peers. And when the timer goes off, they're like, "Miss Thibault, can we please have more time? I didn't get a chance to get to everyone." And I say, "Okay, sure. We'll take the day." And we did. It took the entire class period. But by the end of the day, all of these 34 students had asked to make sure they got to every one of their peers. And all of them had 34 reasons for why they are so important to their peers. And they weren't fixed. There was not going to be a way to fix them. But they were leaving the class today just a little bit better. It's the last day of school in 2022, and I resigned 2 weeks ago. This is sixth period, juniors, American Lit, and we're getting ready for the last power clap. And the class all starts taking their phones out, and as we've established, I don't let students have their phones. But what are you guys doing? And they're like, "Thibault, we got to get the last power clap." And I end up setting up my own phone so we can get it on video and they can all participate. And the bell rings and I go to open the door, and there's this line of students going out the door, coming up to say goodbye. And up walks Maria, red-faced and crying. And she says, "Miss Thibault, I really wanted to take a picture with you, but I'm crying too hard." And I tell her, "No, honey, we have to take this photo because it's important for us to share this, and it's important for us to remember this. Goodbyes are important." And I give her a big hug. She walks off. But the last student in line is a young man named Nathan. Nathan lives with autism, and he had eaten lunch in my room most days of the school year that year. And he would venture into some conversations with his peers. Sometimes he'd work on his homework, but he ate there all the time, and we'd gotten to know each other really well. And he'd been perseverating over how he was going to say goodbye. And he walked up to me and he said, "I don't do hugs." And I say, "I know." And I put my hand out to shake his hand. And he puts his hand out to shake my hand. And then he pulls it away. And he wraps me in a giant bear hug. And he says, "Thank you." And he walks away. You see, the power clap ended up starting out as just this thing to say goodbye, to finish out our school day and be done. But it ended up becoming this really powerful way to build community with students. When we challenge them, when we nurture their spirits, when we just love who they are, we get to build this community that's not just us teaching them, but them also connecting with each other and them finding these safe adults that really help make them so much stronger and more prepared to go out into the world. So even when it's hard in this teaching environment, when we're able to take that time, able to have such an impact for ourselves, but also for our students. Power clap on three. 1, 2, 3.
That was Allison Thibault. Up next is Schwing. This story does include mention of self-harm.
"I am reaching my destination, Nirvana. Am I a better human now? Because I felt like I was, which must be simply my arrogance. Am I even worthy enough to tell my story? This happened inside my brain before I decided to be on this stage tonight. I have anxiety and depression. I did not even know I had until recently, for 30 years. Healing has become a lifelong pursuit. After trying everything to improve my health, I ended up establishing no contact with my family. After a while, I finally feel safe to tell about my past and how I grew up in Japan.
I am ready to appreciate that I developed these symptoms. It cultivated my skills to thrive today, and why my past made me a coach, both in Japan and Alaska, and a lifelong learner. Have your children asked you, why do we have to study? Of course, we have questioned that when we were a child, and now we have to answer as a responsible adult. My parents gave me an example of wrong answers, not to let them regret having me. Japanese society still forces Japanese to get married and have a child by 30, or they are labeled as a useless leftover. Well, we like microwave leftovers. Both my mother and father had a difficulty communicating and developing healthy boundaries. My father was drunk 24/7. My dysfunctional family and social stigmatism cultivated my clown-type personality, excess cheerfulness, and nihilistic dark humor, all of them to conceal my shameful, bottomless depression. Nonetheless, it's just one side of the diverse Asian culture. I'm not speaking on behalf of the entire region. I do not speak Asian. English was and still is the most helpful tool to me to overcome the past. I started learning English when I turned 18. I attended 3 months intensive English program in Canada. Since then, my life has changed. Japan is not a leading country in the study of psychology. I started searching and reading psychology in English. For example, the controversial book, The Chrysanthemum and the Sword, written by an American anthropologist who studied Japanese Americans during World War II. The book gave me a better understanding of my morality from the truly third-party view. It took me 5 years to be fluent in English, to communicate freely, and to pass exams. I came to Alaska as a graduate student and saw my first counselor and psychiatrist. Because it is a shame to see a counselor and how limited the number of counselors available in Japan, suicide is thus number one cause of death among the age group of 15 to 39. I have tried to kill myself as well. Learning new languages means appreciating their point of view. All knowledge is indigenous somewhere. Here I claim that an accent is never a shame. It is the proof of braveness. So get out of your comfort zone. Find your blind spot bias and enjoy the culture shock. Speaking of the culture shocks, while working as a teacher, was how different the educational philosophies were. Japanese educators like the term collective responsibility. The concept has been cultivated through the Shinto constitution and Buddhism. The constitution was written in the year 604. The first article is not to bother others and to follow the rule. We teach children to sit at their desk straight and write kanji letters precisely. There are no janitors. We have to clean our mess. You go to school by yourself and use public transportation alone from 6. All we learn is how to behave. The collective responsibility is not to stand out in either a good or a bad way. You're expected to learn to act like a fool if you know more than your teacher. Age is important. For example, there's no grade skipping system. Fresh college graduates are the most favored by companies. We all attach face pictures on our resume, and the female have to wear skirts. We are living in harmony by hiding our uniqueness and being judgmental. We are not shy. Harmony is also a key word for Buddhism, to be no self, to think of our bodies as containers of soul, which belongs to the holistic nature. There are gods of sun, rocks, water, agriculture, and even a bathroom and yaoyorozu, which means 8 millions of gods. This concept is opposed to the education based on Christianity and monotheism. It is to teach and make children feel that everybody is respected, special, and unique. They can be anything they want to be and still be loved unconditionally. Today I'm living in a dilemma and overwhelmed sometimes, and I scream too much freedom. I'm not saying that we have to choose one over the other. Everything has pros and cons. Just be open-minded. I believe that immersion of both concepts would create more inclusive environment. Why do we have to study? I would answer to the younger myself, who was vulnerable, depressed, and anxious about disappointing others. Others will help you to study, but only you can study for yourself and get ready to protect yourself. Live by yourself. Then start the journey to your nirvana.
That was Shwing sharing her story. And now we've come to our final storyteller. Here's Sam Jordan.
I want to tell you a story about imagination, about rat pee, about New Jersey, and how I probably almost got fired in my second year of teaching. So it is important to say right from the beginning that no rodents were harmed in this story. I started my education career 23 years ago in special education. My first position was at a large charter school in northern New Jersey, and I ran a resource room and did all kinds of support for kids across kindergarten through sixth grade. My second year, I had a small reading remediation group, fifth graders. And for part of that year, we read a book called The Flowers for Algernon. If you know about this book, concerns a mouse named Algernon, who's been given experimental treatments to enhance his intelligence. And then one of the ways that they are measuring that intelligence is by running him through different kinds of mazes. So with this small group of kids, as you can imagine, this is a reading remediation group. Reading's tough. These are struggling readers. And so we're going through it and we're talking about the story. We're talking about this mouse and we're talking about mazes. And, even through the toughness of reading, I begin to see that there's this challenge that we have. Kids don't seem to really know what a maze is. Now, I'm a big believer in hands-on experiential learning. I guess it comes from growing up as a kid of a shop teacher. I spent a lot of time in my dad's middle school classroom surrounded by wood dust and wires and glue and tools and all, just tons of projects that are in motion. I really believe in those things that you can touch, that you can create, that you can experience, and that those things stay with you and they engage you more deeply in the content and really shape you into a lifelong learner. So my solution to this challenge of my kids not knowing what mazes were was to take a time out. So the next day when my students entered the classroom, on the table, what they found was a big pile of cardboard, some hot glue, some scissors, and a bunch of examples of mazes. And we spent the next two classes designing our own mazes, cutting out all the walls, gluing everything down within an inch of its life. And of course, this group of 10 to 11-year-olds were 100% into it. We were doing art and construction and reading class, right? It's great. So now here is where my second year teaching self probably crossed the line. I wanted to take this just a little bit further. But where do you get a mouse in New Jersey that you can bring into a classroom to really bring that learning home? So my school was next to a mall, and in that mall was a pet store. So during my lunch break, I popped over to the mall and got into conversation with the manager at the pet store. And I told him, look, I'm a teacher. There's a school down the street. That's where I teach. And I know this sounds a little bit weird, but I'd like to rent a rat to show my kids, how the rats can go through mazes. And I promise I won't hurt it. I just need it for like 2 hours. So I'm looking at this guy and I see he's, kind of staring me down and probably thinking about all the ways he could get into trouble. But ultimately, in typical New Jersey fashion, the guy just kind of shrugs and says, yeah, all right. So cut to Mr. Jordan walking back down the street to my school. I got a little box with some holes in it for air to come in through and a probably terrified rat bouncing along inside. So my students, they show up to class that day, and I pull out this red-eyed, pale, scaly-tailed, terrified rat. And of course, it is mild chaos. And we ran that poor rat through our mazes, and we talked about the intelligence needed to navigate mazes and how complicated it would be from the rat's perspective. It was great. And at the end, I gathered that rat back up in my arms, and, you know, it was clawing up into my shoulder. And at that point, in what instantly became, in my students' minds, the greatest thing that had ever happened in their school careers, I feel a growing warmth across my shoulder and then ultimately down my chest. This little dude had peed all over me. So class ends. I return the rat unharmed back to the shop. And importantly, I did not get fired. Then the next day, we cracked those books back open. And it's still hard, right? This is a remedial reading class. It's tough for my kids to move through it. But the conversations that we had were so much richer. They were infused with a new enthusiasm, nuance, that context about what mazes are. And we read all the way through to the end of those books. Now, I look back on that moment as a new teacher and admire the sense of adventure that I had, of being willing to, you know, unknowingly push on the boundaries of typical instruction. I think about this experience and other similar moments, because folks, there were other times like this in my classroom, and how it set the stage for how I've really viewed teaching for the next 20 years of my career, that it's got to be exciting. It's got to be hands-on, meaningful, constructive of foundations that kids can continue to build knowledge on throughout the rest of their lives. And that it is such an opportunity for us to do something as educators that is impactful and memorable like this in their lives. And of course, I will bet you that if you went back to Jersey City today and pulled aside Jonathan or Nathan or Tanisha on the street and you asked if they remember Mr. Jordan, I am pretty sure that the first thing that they would say is, "Oh yeah, that's that guy who the rat peed on. We read that book about mazes."
Our final storyteller this hour was Sam Jordan. Thanks for joining us today for Addressing Alaskans. Today's program featured stories from Teacher Tales, a storytelling event celebrating educators and all that they do. It was presented by Hearthkin and Sea Stories. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ammon Swenson. Thanks for listening.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.